Chapter 70. King James II was a man so very disagreeable that even the best of historians has favored his brother Charles as becoming, by comparison, quite a pleasant character. The one object of his short reign was to re-establish the Catholic religion in England, and this he doggedly pursued with such a stupid obstinacy that his career very soon came to a close. The first thing he did was to assure his council that he would make it his endeavor to preserve the government, both in church and state, as it was by law established, and that he would always take care to defend and support the church. Great public acclamations were raised over this fair speech, and a great deal was said, from the pulpits and elsewhere, about the word of a king which was never broken, by credulous people who little supposed that he had formed a secret council for Catholic affairs, of which a mischievous Jesuit, called Father Petter, was one of the chief members. With tears of joy in his eyes, he received, as the beginning of his pension from the King of France, 500,000 livres. Yet, with a mixture of meanness and arrogance that belonged to his contemptible character, he was always jealous of making some show of being independent of the King of France, while he pocketed his money. As notwithstanding his publishing two papers in favor of popery and not likely to do it much service, I should think, written by the king, his brother, and found in his strong box, and his open display of himself attending mass, the parliament was very obsequious, and granted him a large sum of money, he began his reign with a belief that he could do what he pleased, and with a determination to do it. Before we proceed to its principal events, let us dispose of Titus Oates. He was tried for perjury a fortnight after the coronation, and besides being very heavily fined, was sentenced to stand twice in the pillory, to be whipped from Aldgate to Newgate one day, and from Newgate to Tyburn 2 days afterwards, and to stand in the pillory 5 times a year, as long as he lived. This fearful sentence was actually inflicted on the rascal. Being unable to stand after his first flogging, he was dragged on a sledge from Newgate to Tyburn, and flogged as he was drawn along. He was so strong a villain that he did not die under the torture, but lived to be afterwards pardoned and rewarded, though not to be ever believed in any more. Dangerfield, the only other one of that crew left alive, was not so fortunate. He was almost killed by a whipping from Newgate to Tyburn, and, as if that were not punishment enough, a ferocious barrister of Gray's Inn gave him a poke in the eye with his cane, which caused his death, for which the ferocious barrister was deservedly tried and executed. As soon as James was on the throne, Argyll and Monmouth went from Brussels to Rotterdam, and attended a meeting of Scottish exiles held there, to concert measures for a rising in England. It was agreed that Argyll should effect a landing in Scotland, and Monmouth in England, and that two Englishmen should be sent with Argyll, to be in his confidence, and two Scotchmen with the Duke of Monmouth. Argyll was the first to act upon this contract. But two of his men, being taken prisoners at the Orkney Islands, the government became aware of his intention, and was able to act against him with such vigor as to prevent his raising more than 2,000 or 3,000 Highlanders, although he sent a fiery cross, by trusty messengers, from clan to clan, and from glen to glen, as the custom then was when those wild people were to be excited by their chiefs. As he was moving towards Glasgow with his small force, he was betrayed by some of his followers, taken, and carried, with his hands tied behind his back, to his old prison in Edinburgh Castle. James ordered him to be executed, on his old shamefully unjust sentence, within 3 days, and he appears to have been anxious that his legs should have been pounded with his old favorite the boot. However, the boot was not applied. He was simply beheaded, and his head was set upon the top of Edinburgh jail. One of those Englishmen who had been assigned to him was that old soldier Rumbold, the master of the Rye House. He was sorely wounded, and within a week after Argyle had suffered with great courage, was brought up for trial, lest he should die and disappoint the king. He too was executed, after defending himself with great spirit, and saying that he did not believe that God had made the greater part of mankind to carry saddles on their backs and bridles in their mouths, and to be ridden by a few, booted and spurred for the purpose, in which I thoroughly agree with Rumbold. The Duke of Monmouth, partly through being detained, and partly through idling his time away, was 5 or 6 weeks behind his friend when he landed at Lyme, in Dorset, having at his right hand an unlucky nobleman called Lord Grey of Werk, who of himself would have ruined a far more promising expedition. He immediately set up his standard in the marketplace, and proclaimed the king a tyrant, and a popish usurper, and I know not what else, charging him, not only with what he had done, which was bad enough, but with what neither he nor anybody else had done, such as setting fire to London, and poisoning the late king. Raising some 4,000 men by these means, he marched on to Taunton, where there were many Protestant dissenters who were strongly opposed to the Catholics. Here, both the rich and poor turned out to receive him. Ladies waved a welcome to him from all the windows as he passed along the streets, flowers were strewn in his way, and every compliment and honor that could be devised was showered upon him. Among the rest, 20 young ladies came forward, in their best clothes, and in their brightest beauty, and gave him a Bible ornamented with their own fair hands, together with other presents. Encouraged by this homage, he proclaimed himself king, and went on to Bridgewater. But, here the government troops, under the Earl of Feversham, were close at hand, and he was so dispirited at finding that he made but few powerful friends after all, that it was a question whether he should disband his army and endeavor to escape. It was resolved, at the instance of that unlucky Lord Grey, to make a night attack on the king's army, as it lay encamped on the edge of a morass called Sedgemoor. The horsemen were commanded by the same unlucky lord, who was not a brave man. He gave up the battle almost at the first obstacle, which was a deep drain, and although the poor countrymen, who had turned out for Monmouth, fought bravely with scythes, poles, pitchforks, and such poor weapons as they had, they were soon dispersed by the trained soldiers, and fled in all directions. When the Duke of Monmouth himself fled, was not known in the confusion, but the unlucky Lord Grey was taken early next day, and then another of the party was taken, who confessed that he had parted from the Duke only 4 hours before. Strict search being made, he was found disguised as a peasant, hidden in a ditch under fern and nettles, with a few peas in his pocket which he had gathered in the fields to eat. The only other articles he had upon him were a few papers and little books. One of the latter, being a strange jumble, in his own writing, of charms, songs, recipes, and prayers. He was completely broken. He wrote a miserable letter to the king, beseeching and entreating to be allowed to see him. When he was taken to London, and conveyed bound into the king's presence, he crawled to him on his knees, and made a most degrading exhibition. As James never forgave or relented towards anybody, he was not likely to soften towards the issuer of the Lyme proclamation, so he told the suppliant to prepare for death. On the 15th of July, 1685, this unfortunate favorite of the people was brought out to die on Tower Hill. The crowd was immense, and the tops of all the houses were covered with gazers. He had seen his wife, the daughter of the Duke of Buccleuch, in the Tower, and had talked much of a lady whom he loved far better, the Lady Harriet Wentworth, who was one of the last persons he remembered in this life. Before laying down his head upon the block, he felt the edge of the axe, and told the executioner that he feared it was not sharp enough, and that the axe was not heavy enough. On the executioner replying that it was of the proper kind, the Duke said, "I pray you have a care, and do not use me so awkwardly as you used my Lord Russell." apostrophe the executioner, made nervous by this, and trembling, struck once and nearly gashed him in the neck. Upon this, the Duke of Monmouth raised his head, and looked the man reproachfully in the face. Then he struck twice, and then thrice, and then threw down the axe, and cried out in a voice of horror that he could not finish that work. The sheriffs, however, threatening him with what should be done to himself, if he did not, he took it up again, and struck a fourth time and a fifth time. Then the wretched head at last fell off, and James, Duke of Monmouth, was dead, in the 36th year of his age. He was a showy, graceful man, with many popular qualities, and had found much favor in the open arts of the English. The atrocities, committed by the government, which followed this Monmouth rebellion, form the blackest and most lamentable page in English history. The poor peasants, having been dispersed with great loss, and their leaders having been taken, one would think that the implacable king might have been satisfied. But no, he let loose upon them, among other intolerable monsters, a Colonel Kirke, who had served against the Moors, and whose soldiers called by the people Kirke's lambs, because they bore a lamb upon their flag, as the emblem of Christianity were worthy of their leader. The atrocities committed by these demons in human shape are far too horrible to be related here. It is enough to say that besides most ruthlessly murdering and robbing them, and ruining them by making them buy their pardons at the price of all they possessed, it was one of Kirke's favorite amusements, as he and his officers sat drinking after dinner, and toasting the king, to have batches of prisoners hanged outside the windows for the company's diversion, and that when their feet quivered in the convulsions of death, he used to swear that they should have music to their dancing, and would order the drums to beat, and the trumpets to play. The detestable king informed him, as an acknowledgement of these services, that he was very well satisfied with his proceedings. Apostrophe but the king's great delight was in the proceedings of Jeffreys, now a peer, who went down into the West, with four other judges, to try persons accused of having had any share in the rebellion. The king pleasantly called this Jeffreys' campaign. Apostrophe the people down in that part of the country remember it to this day as the Bloody Assize. It began at Winchester, where a poor deaf old lady, Mrs. Alicia Lysell, the widow of one of the judges of Charles I, who had been murdered abroad by some royalist assassins, was charged with having given shelter in her house to two fugitives from Sedgemoor. Three times the jury refused to find her guilty, until Jeffreys bullied and frightened them into that false verdict. When he had extorted it from them, he said, "Gentlemen, if I had been one of you, and she had been my own mother, I would have found her guilty, apostrophe as I dare say he would." He sentenced her to be burned alive, that very afternoon. The clergy of the cathedral and some others interfered in her favor, and she was beheaded within a week. As a high mark of his approbation, the king made Jeffreys Lord Chancellor, and he then went on to Dorchester, to Exeter, to Taunton, and to Wells. It is astonishing, when we read of the enormous injustice and barbarity of this beast, to know that no one struck him dead on the judgment seat. It was enough for any man or woman, to be accused by an enemy, before Jeffreys, to be found guilty of high treason. One man who pleaded not guilty, he ordered to be taken out of court upon the instant, and hanged. And this so terrified the prisoners in general, that they mostly pleaded guilty at once. At Dorchester alone, in the course of a few days, Jeffreys hanged 80 people, besides whipping, transporting, imprisoning, and selling as slaves, great numbers. He executed, in all, 250, or 300. These executions took place, among the neighbors and friends of the sentenced, in 36 towns and villages. Their bodies were mangled, steeped in cauldrons of boiling pitch and tar, and hung up by the roadsides, in the streets, over the very churches. the sight and smell of heads and limbs, the hissing and bubbling of the infernal cauldrons, and the tears and terrors of the people, were dreadful beyond all description. One rustic, who was forced to steep the remains in the black pot, was ever afterwards called Tom Boilman. Apostrophe the hangman has ever since been called Jack Ketch, because a man of that name went hanging and hanging, all day long, in the train of Jeffreys. You will hear much of the horrors of the great French Revolution. Many and terrible they were, there is no doubt, but I know of nothing worse, done by the maddened people of France in that awful time, than was done by the highest judge in England, with the express approval of the King of England, in the bloody assize. Nor was even this all. Jeffreys was as fond of money for himself, as of misery for others, and he sold pardons wholesale to fill his pockets. The king ordered, at one time, 1,000 prisoners to be given to certain of his favorites, in order that they might bargain with them for their pardons. The young ladies of Taunton who had presented the Bible, were bestowed upon the maids of honor at court, and those precious ladies made very hard bargains with them indeed. When the bloody assize was at its most dismal height, the king was diverting himself with horse races in the very place where Mrs. Lysell had been executed. When Jeffreys had done his worst, and came home again, he was particularly complimented in the Royal Gazette, and when the king heard that through drunkenness and raging he was very ill, his odious majesty remarked that such another man could not easily be found in England. Besides all this, a former sheriff of London, named Cornish, was hanged within sight of his own house, after an abominably conducted trial, for having had a share in the Rye House plot, on evidence given by Rumsey, which that villain was obliged to confess, was directly opposed to the evidence he had given on the trial of Lord Russell. And on the very same day, a worthy widow, named Elizabeth Gaunt, was burned alive at Tyburn, for having sheltered a wretch who himself gave evidence against her. She settled the fuel about herself with her own hands, so that the flames should reach her quickly, and nobly said, with her last breath, that she had obeyed the sacred command of God, to give refuge to the outcast, and not to betray the wanderer. After all this hanging, beheading, burning, boiling, mutilating, exposing, robbing, transporting, and selling into slavery, of his unhappy subjects, the king not unnaturally thought that he could do whatever he would. So, he went to work to change the religion of the country with all possible speed, and what he did was this. He first of all tried to get rid of what was called the Test Act, which prevented the Catholics from holding public employments by his own power of dispensing with the penalties. He tried it in one case, and, 11 of the 12 judges deciding in his favor, he exercised it in 3 others, being those of 3 dignitaries of University College, Oxford, who had become papists, and whom he kept in their places and sanctioned. He revived the hated ecclesiastical commission, to get rid of Compton, Bishop of London, who manfully opposed him. He solicited the Pope, to favor England with an ambassador, which the Pope, who was a sensible man then, rather unwillingly did. He flourished Father Petter before the eyes of the people on all possible occasions. He favored the establishment of convents in several parts of London. He was delighted to have the streets, and even the court itself, filled with monks and friars in the habits of their orders. He constantly endeavored to make Catholics of the Protestants about him. He held private interviews, which he called closetings, apostrophe with those members of Parliament who held offices, to persuade them to consent to the design he had in view. When they did not consent, they were removed, or resigned of themselves, and their places were given to Catholics. He displaced Protestant officers from the army, by every means in his power, and got Catholics into their places too. He tried the same thing with the corporations, and also, though not so successfully, with the Lord Lieutenants of counties. To terrify the people into the endurance of all these measures, He kept an army of 15,000 men encamped on Hounslow Heath, where mass was openly performed in the general's tent, and where priests went among the soldiers endeavoring to persuade them to become Catholics. For circulating a paper among those men advising them to be true to their religion, a Protestant clergyman, named Johnson, the chaplain of the late Lord Russell, was actually sentenced to stand 3 times in the pillory, and was actually whipped from Newgate to Tyburn. He dismissed his own brother-in-law from his council, because he was a Protestant, and made a privy councillor of the before-mentioned Father Petre. He handed Ireland over to Richard Talbot, Earl of Tyrconnell, a worthless, dissolute knave, who played the same game there for his master, and who played the deeper game for himself of one day putting it under the protection of the French king. And going to these extremities, every man of sense and judgment among the Catholics, from the Pope. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.